Tonight on Arena, we review the Playboy of the Western World in London, Stellan Skarsgård and Joachim Trier on sentimental value, and a new play, Robin and Dawn. You're very welcome along to Wednesday night's Arena. Our text number open as usual on 51551. WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. Grafton Street in Dublin may be bustling with shoppers right now, and if you're braving the shops while listening to Arena, I'm impressed. But in the days following the festive period, Bewley's Cafe Theatre will see the premiere of a new play set in the wilds of County Kerry. Robin and Dawn is the story of a couple who've become like ships passing in the night until a haunting encounter on a dark mountain road shakes the relationship to its very core. I'm delighted that writer Michael Hilliard-Mulcahy and director Padraig McIntyre join us this evening. Gents, you're both very welcome to Arena.
Good evening, Rick.
Thanks.
Mick, Robin and Dawn, tell us about this couple's life to begin with.
Okay. Robin's a musician, and Dawn, his wife or partner, have been together about 20 years. My own feeling is they probably met around the early 90s or whatever, and locally, Robin is a musician that, kind of toured around the villages and towns of Kerry and Cork maybe or whatever, and played in every kind of a hall and every kind of a pub, and a kind of a local troubadour type of guy. Might have played in bands, might have popped off to over to London for a while or up to Dublin, might have had a little bit of success. They're together a long time, and I don't think things have worked out quite what Robin would have liked them. You know, his dreams, I think, are a little bit smashed. I think he held, hopes of being a great singer-songwriter or whatever, and it just didn't quite work out that way. That's part of the pain in his life, but it's not all of it. Him and Dawn are together a long time, and they've had decisions to make. They don't have any kids, and they've hit a bit of a crisis point, and it comes to a head, I think, in this play, in these days and weeks during the course, the action takes place probably over days and weeks, and of very much a bleak winter, and it kind of comes to a head. He's travelling one night over a mountain in his car, coming from a gig late at night. He's driving across the peninsula over a mountain road. In my mind, it's a road called Bohorn na Gluck. It's not Connor Pass. It's another road that you drive right through the mountains. It's very bleak. If you were up there tonight, there wouldn't be a lot going on. There'd be kind of 6 miles of no lights or seven. You'd see, when you get to the top of the hill, you'd see, if it was a bright night, you might see the ocean on both sides of you. But one night, while travelling that road, he experiences something that he can't explain. It shocks him to his very core. It comes from a story I heard locally, and a kind of a story that didn't leave me. And I just always wanted to use it. I wanted to write it and put it in a bigger story. And I could never quite find that bigger story for it or that character to tell this story. But in Robin and Dawn, I believe I probably have it now.
I'm interested to know why now then. What happened now that made you find that moment that you thought, well, this is the place I can put them?
Yeah, I think another source of the inspiration probably came during COVID. I was watching a lot of theatre online, like people were, and I got online to the old Vic. I saw a production of Faith Healer with Michael Sheen, the Welsh actor. Is Michael Sheen, yeah? He was playing the Frank Hardy character. And I'd seen the play a couple of times. But on this occasion, it just blew me away. I don't know, maybe it was the quietness of it, of his voice coming through the laptop. It was the laptop sitting on my lap, and in the coziness of my own room. And, there was something very intimate about it. And I heard Faith Healer really for the first time. And I said, I'd love to have a go at that form, monologue form. And it started to get into my head then that maybe my character as a musician, and maybe, it's in monologues that he has to tell his story. And one of those stories is what he encounters on that mountain road at night. And then it kind of worked its way from there, Rick, in the relationship with his partner, Dawn. At one stage, there was three characters in it. So there was another shamanic healer lady called Swan. That was her power animal name. So just like Faith Healer, I was trying the tree hander, mm-hmm. but I thought that I didn't need her. She's very central to the story, but she's physically not there as a character. It's a two-hander.
Luckily, which we don't always have when it comes to new theatre productions, we actually do have a clip of John Cronin as Robin. This is Robin believing that he's going mad. He is in a state of profound distress, and Dawn says that she'll take him to the doctor, and he doesn't resist.
The doctor's given me a lecture about how I'm shoving on a bit and I need to start taking care of myself. Asking if I smoke. I knew that was coming. I gave them up, I tell him, thinking he'll give me a pat on the back. But of course, obvious question number two was fired in my direction instead, and the whole minefield of alcohol is on the table. And I'm being honest with him when I say I've had wild times. Comes with the territory. I'm a musician, you know, crack, like. I tell him he played in several bands and lived in London and Dublin and had some success too. And he's asking me the name of the bands I played with, and I'm listing them off one by one, but just like I thought, he hasn't a notion who the bands were. Why did he ask? I should have told him it was the guitarist and fucking Coldplay or something. Sure, he wouldn't know any better, the nerdy little prick.
Porrick, as a director, what was it that you found attractive about this play that made you think, okay, this one's for me?
I think it's the story. I think it's an amazing story. I love what Mick has done. He has taken the contemporary. The couple are living now in a contemporary time in the west of Ireland. And then the cross over with ancestry, with the landscape of where it is set, with what ancestors mean to us, with the story that Mick talks that he encounters on that road, is spellbinding, and just the attraction of the monologue form in Bewley's, the intimacy of that. So all them things combined. So when I was approached, I went, yeah, this is something I'd love to get my teeth into.
We talked to a lot of actors, writers and directors who've been involved specifically in productions in the Bewley's Cafe Theatre this year, because it is such a unique space and because the audience is so very, very close to you. Talk to me about maybe either the constraints of directing in a space like that or the joys of directing a production in a space like that.
Yeah, well, I think you always try to throw everything into the mix, and probably the first week of rehearsals that we had was doing all the things that we couldn't do in Bewley's then because of the constraints you're talking about. But in a way, that was great for the actors to find stuff. So you nearly let it free for a while and then you have to bring it back. You get the measurements down on the floor and you go, right, this is what we're working in. But then after exploring all that in a bigger way, really, then there's nearly a freedom, especially in this form, in the monologue, just to tell the story. Because, as I said, that's what attracted me in the first place. I think that's what attracted the two actors that's doing it maybe in the first place. And it's storytelling and poetic language that Michael uses. And as I say, in a contemporary setting, and all that just seems to marry together in this.
What about the two actors then? You've got Rosanna Purcell who's playing Dawn and John Cronin who's playing Robin. Talk to me about the casting of them and what they bring to those roles.
Yeah, well, I think me and Mick and David and Isolde and Bewley's had a chat, and, you know, we felt, you know, certainly Dawn was definitely rural from that part. I had worked with Rosanna before. And she came to mind, and I think she was a great choice. It's working out really well in rehearsals. She understands the language. She had done a play with Mick before as well, so she understands where Mick was coming from. Robin, I suppose, as we've said, has toured probably. He's been in Dublin, he's been in London, and the lifestyle he leads. And again, I was lucky enough to work with John in the past, and I just felt he'd have the intensity for this, because, you know, this guy has gone through turmoil of the highest degree, and I was delighted when the two of them agreed to do it.
I'm always interested in it, Mick, when you've got, as a writer, you have a script and then actors become involved and that brings something completely new and something different to it and maybe makes it a different piece than the piece you originally thought it was going to be. What's that been like for you in this instance in terms of the casting and the actors who are playing the two roles?
Well, I had those actors in mind as well, and I had John for readings. Roseanne was in a play of mine 12 years ago, so I know what she brings to the table. And John nearly worked with him, and nearly worked with Porrig a couple of times, but it didn't happen. It's happening now. I was in rehearsals today, and it's really early stages, you know, and they're really, it's a process, isn't it? They're really, I have no, you know, I just, I'm excited by it. I think they're going to be great, you know, and you know, they've been around a while now, and you can see, like, last time I was in a rehearsal room with Roseanne, she was very young, and I think it was one of her first gigs she was doing, Beyond the Brooklyn Sky, and you can see now how she's really matured as an actor, you know. It's exciting. I have a lot of time for both actors. They have to go their own way and bring their own thing to it. I can imagine what it'd be like when I'm sitting there writing all I want, but you get pleasantly surprised when actors then take it somewhere else and a director, and it goes on its own journey. And you know, I have to leave it go as a writer, and I have to give it over, and let the interpretation, you know, happen. And it works out. It always works out. You know, it's great. It's lovely to be stepping back from it, you know. It really is. In the past, I worried a little bit about productions and plays and a little bit too much. And I'm really I'm delighted Porrig's directing it. I'm delighted with the two actors, and I'm really kind of happy to be stepping back from it. It's nice to dip in and out of rehearsals.
But not to be there all the time.
No, God, no.
We get an insight into Robin's emotional life through this monologues. How important is it that we hear what men are really thinking in this context?
Yeah, I think the Dawn character is ahead of him in terms of their recent traumas, you know, that they've had and their difficulties. And I sense that Dawn, I was watching it again today, and I was watching, and sometimes you forget, you've written the thing, and you're forgetting, I forget what's coming next. But they were taking me on the journey in the rehearsal room, and it was great. But I sense that she's way ahead of him in terms of the grief. And like a lot of the times, a man can be left a little bit behind. And I sense from it, the type of man he is, that if he didn't encounter what he encountered on the mountain road, he might never talk. It's a kind of a bolt of lightning out of the blue. Something happens. Something unexplainable in this incident, you know, and something has to happen for these two people to reconnect. And when she finds him in the morning, in the early hours of the morning, sitting there absolutely rocked, they have no choice but to communicate again, but he's got to try and catch up with her, because in their journey emotionally, she has begun, let's say, the healing process, whilst he hasn't, you know. And the interesting thing is can he will he get there, will he catch up, you know, what will happen? It's an open ending. I don't know, but I'd be hopeful, you know.
I want to take a little of one of Dawn's monologues here as well. This is where she's seen a dramatic change in Robin, and he's not the same man since the experience he's had on the way home in the early hours of the morning. So she wakes early and decides to do something that she never does, and she goes for a walk through the wet village streets. This is Rosanna Purcell as Dawn.
I'm going by the old dance hall. The roof is after falling in. When did that happen? Why am I only noticing this now? They've the place fenced off too, in case the whole thing collapses, I guess. Tempted to climb in over the fence and walk across the old stage, if it's still sitting there, that is. It's where we first got together. I can see him there still with his band, and he thinking he's Kurt Cobain. The hall jammed with locals and tourists alike. And on those summer nights after the gigs, we'd head for the beach and party on, gangs of us. Mornings, they went straight from there to work, but myself and Kurt Cobain would be the last to leave. The two of us cuddled into one another under a sand dune. Innocent days.
Porrig, Music and sound are very much elements in this play as well, whether it's the sound of nature or it's the guitar that Robin is playing. Talk to me about your work with that.
Yeah, well, today was the first time H. Kenny Shordan is doing the sound design for us, and we've been having a lot of discussions because I suppose that's one thing in Bewley's that isn't limited. And it's so important, as you said, the landscape, the guitar, the healing shaman woman, Swan, drumming. So it was really important. So it was just amazing today. And I think we all in the afternoon went, OK, we're on to something, when we had some sound in today. So HK has gone home to do some edits or whatever. But I think that's going to be really the third character in this. And it sort of has to be because of the landscape and the territory we're in.
I was going to ask you, Mick, there's a great sense in this play, obviously, of being set where it is, being set open to the elements all along the Atlantic coasts. And you're from Dingle yourself.
The Dingle Peninsula.
Does that place influence your work and your writing in general in a big way?
Well, it's hard to get away from it, you know. Like, I was up in the Glenties during the and I was in Brian Friel country, and I was looking at the one hotel he talks about in Philadelphia, the Highland. The Highlander, I think, of the Highland Hotel. And it's no wonder he wrote what he wrote, you know, in that town. It's the same with me. I just, it's my the elements, the landscape, the whole, it's my Greece. These are my Greek gods, Mount Brandon. And like, even there, I was there over the weekend and it was bleak and it was raining and it was windy. And it's like a mirror up to your soul, you know. And then Monday morning when I was coming back to Dublin, I stopped off in Cam Strand, went down, the sea was glistening blue and it was a different world. So I think that the elements, the whole landscape, it's like a mirror up to the soul of the artist or just the regular, ordinary man on the street, you know. I think like, I can identify more with the Dawn character when she takes those walks. And just listening to her there, she walks through her life. And she talks about that village hall, and that's there. I've seen it pull down. I've seen it fall down. I've seen the roof come down. I like to walk those village streets. I like to walk the beach in the evening under the stars. My mother used to think it was mad. She'd say, "Where were you? I was out walking." On a wild, windy night in the middle of nowhere. Like,
they catch you dead of cold.
Yeah, yeah. But she used to say, "What? Where were you?" Like, but I suppose there's a reason for it. And these images that they talk about, and this lake and the sea and the ancestral home and the mountain, you know, they're for a reason. They're not just there to add a bit of colour to it. They play their part. They're very much part of the plot. And it was a great place to grow up. And so when I'm writing, it just kind of, that's where it goes every time. And even the plays that that are sitting there that haven't been produced, that same, you know.
It's been great to talk to both of you, particularly at an early stage where not everything is set in stone as of yet. I wish you nothing but luck with the rest of the rehearsals as they go along. Writer Michael Hilliard-Mulcahy and director Padraig McIntyre, thanks for joining us on Arena.
Thanks, Rick.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
Robin and Dawn opens at Bewley's Cafe Theatre on Grafton Street in Dublin in the new year. The previews are on the 5th and 6th of January. The play then runs until the end of the month, and you'll find more details at Bewley'sCafeTheatre.com. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Sentimental Value is the new family psychodrama from Joachim Trier, the Oscar-nominated director of 2021's The Worst Person in the World. The new release stars Stellan Skarsgård and Renata Reinsve and already is being hailed as one of the films of the year. In contemporary Oslo, two sisters, Nora and Agnes, anticipate the return of their aging father to the family home after the death of their mother, who he walked out on many years ago. He's Gustav Borg, a celebrated Scandinavian arthouse film director, who is now in his twilight years, but determined to keep working on a film about his own mother's suicide when he was a boy. Into this powder keg walks Rachel Kemp, the Hollywood starlet, who has signed on to star in the film after Gustav's actor daughter Nora declined, Nora being played by Renata Reinsve. Sentimental Value opens in Irish cinemas on December 26th. Already the film has received 8 Golden Globe nominations, including a Best Supporting Actor one for Stellan Skarsgård, and there's hope for an Oscar nomination for him next year as well. Recently, Sinead Egan spoke to writer-director Joachim Trier and star Stellan Skarsgård about the film, but before we hear that conversation, let's get something from it. In this scene, Elle Fanning, as film star Rachel Kemp, is introduced by Gustav to his daughter Agnes, who we learn starred in his most celebrated film when she was a child. Agnes is played by Inga Ibsdottir Lilias.
Rachel, this is my daughter Agnes.
Hi, Rachel.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Are you in the business as well?
Oh, no.
No, she helps me with research sometimes.
Yeah, I'm an academic historian. Yes. Sorry, I'm... Nå får jeg ikke til å snakke ordentlig.
Do you recognize her? She played Anna in the film you saw.
Oh, yeah, that's a long time ago.
Of course. That's... You're Anna. That's right.
I see it.
Can I take a selfie with you?
Yeah, sure.
Starstruck.
Joachim Trier, Stellan Skarsgård, you're both very welcome back to Arena. Joachim, could you tell us about Gustav Borg and his daughters and what it was about Stellan Skarsgård that made him such a perfect fit for this role?
Yeah, I started with the daughters and I kind of liked them. They were asking themselves questions about how are we so different as siblings, even though we grew up in the same family. Then the father character arrived in the story. And I realized that the more terrible things the father did and the more self-centered he got, the nicer person I needed to actually play him to make him a human being. So on top of that, I've wanted to work with Stellan since I became a director in Scandinavia, but I think also in the world now with all the films he's done. He's really one of the greats, you know, in cinema. So I actually, before the screenplay was finished, I kind of went to Stockholm and met him, and I don't know if the word is begged, but try to convince him at least to be a part of this.
I played along. So, what do you want? You know, I played.
He's a good actor.
Of course, I wanted to play with
Stellan. Gustav is this kind of fragile megalomaniac, and as a father, he's really self-involved. Everything is on his terms with Nora and with Agnes. So for you, what were the keys to finding some humanity and vulnerability in him?
Well, he's human. I didn't have any problems with that, because what he's not a monster as you describe him. He sounds like a monster, but he's a man of an other generation. And he's a man that has inherited some wounds that won't heal. But he's an artist. And artists have a big problem with combining their art with a normal life. And they're nerds. What I really liked about playing it was I loved playing the guy who wants to have a relationship with a daughter but fails. To do the failure, Gustav, was the dream. That worked for me. And so there I started. I started in the middle. And that was the meat. And then I was worried about the last scene for how we should balance that out. But that we did the last thing in the after the shoot, and it went very, very well.
Joachim, in the film, we see Gustav mining his family history, this trauma, and these relationships for his art, for his films. How do you feel about what he's doing here? Do you think he's trying to mend things with his daughters in his own way? Or is he just being selfish?
That's a good question. I don't think he purposefully is selfish. I think he's someone who, to the best abilities he's got, is trying to reach his daughters, and particularly Nora. I think Nora and Gustav are very similar. And I think it pains them. And they're proud, and they somehow have the same pain where they are so well functioning in their craft and their art and feel so lost in terms of human relations and creating a sense of home and connectedness. And I almost look at it like a kind of bittersweet love story between a father and a daughter, and how I believe that reconciliation is possible, but I didn't want to make a kind of a cheap, then they talked and everything was fine, because I don't think that's what life is about. But to try to find the fact that in every family there are those unspoken areas that we're dealing with and struggle with very often, and that maybe in those areas art can arrive or actions can arrive without words that can at least help us get closer to each other in terms of understanding. That's what the story is about, an understanding.
And the thing is that we can't, all of us can't talk about it and have it solve the problem. I mean, there's a lot of unsolvable pieces in this film. And the wonderful thing with the way Joachim is portraying it is he recognizes that there are unsolvable problems in life, and you cannot, like the Americans, well, they want closure on everything, and there's no fucking closure in life. So you don't reach to a point where everything is fine. You reach to a point where everything is possible, and that is fantastic.
Stellan, on that question, though, about what Gustav is trying to achieve in the film, did you see this film within the film that he's making as an attempt for him to secure his artistic legacy, or was it more of an attempt to connect with his daughters?
It's not a cry for help, or it's not something that he's trying to do to reconcile with his daughters. It's a film he wants to make, and he doesn't know why, really. He doesn't know why he wants to make it. But he is at the point in life where suddenly those things float up like lava streams, and they infect you, and you start to deal with them. But he's totally unconscious about any attempts to reconcile.
Joachim, how did you and your co-writer Eskil Vogt navigate that crucial balance that we see in the film, which is, it's in places it's really, really funny about the movie industry, but at the same time it's really deeply serious about intergenerational trauma, and this is what we see play out within the Borg family.
I think I love stories that have the mixture of life between drama and comedy. I that's what we're trying to achieve. You don't plan these things completely. You don't have control. You try to bring your temperament to the big machine of making the endeavor of a movie, and you try to get everyone aligned, and you try to find the best actors that you love and want to work with. And at the end of the day, I think life is both tragic and terribly funny at times. And I think a coping mechanism we all have is to try to find the laughter in the darkness, and, you know, like... But people like Stellan and Renata, you know, they're really funny. So I would be an idiot not to open up to the comical possibilities that arrive, you know. So anyway, I'm glad you find that it has that dichotomy of humor and drama. That's what I like.
And the film has really been praised for its tenderness in dealing with this complicated family. So when you're working with Stellan and with Renata, how did you keep that tenderness, especially in the scenes where they're really exploding with tension?
I think it's about trust and trying to prepare together, have rehearsals where we just get to know each other, and we kind of get done with the talking and analysis, so that when we're on set, we're looking for a vibe and energy, and my job is to try to sustain, help, support, but not get in the way. I feel we're in it together. I sit next to the camera. I try to intuitively just feel and see what's going on and see if I can help a little bit by stimulating, having them let go, try different variations. Mm. It's really a bit of a dance on set. But it's also about casting. With this, sorry for calling you material, man, but like this material, it's actually, it's kind of like good material, a good space, a good scene, and good actors, and a cinematographer like Casper Tuxen, you know,
something will happen.
Something interesting will happen, and it's my job is not to fuck it up. So, there we are.
Stellan, you've worked with so many renowned European auteurs of European cinema and global cinema, and here you are playing a European art house auteur. Were there any real life directors or archetypes that you drew on, or did you focus entirely on the script and on the character that was created for you?
At first, I was tempted. I thought, this can be the revenge moment. I can portray some directors that I really hate. But I gave up that after very quickly. Because it's not important that he's a director. I mean, to me, it could be any artist. It could be a musician, he could be a writer or whatever. Because the conflict is between his need. His need to do his films. His need to be an artist, and he's sucking his energy from that art. That if he leaves that on the side, he will die probably, or he will not be the man he was. And that is something we all have. I mean, not only artists. I mean, even regular people that are interested in their job, they suffer from this conflict.
And what was it like for you, Stellan, to be back working in Scandinavia on a more smaller, more family-centric story, especially after working on such huge productions like Andor and Dune more recently?
Well, it was. I've been going back and forth for 60 years now, so I like it, and it's the, I don't care really if where the project is. I'm not a nationalist in that way. It's the people that counts.
And just a question to end for both of you. Like, complicated families aren't exclusive to Norway or exclusive to Scandinavia. What do you hope audiences will take away from this film about the possibility of communication and reconciliation? I mean, what do you want audiences to feel at the end?
A wonderful thing that's happened with the film already. It's out in France and Norway and a few places, and it's now rolling out in the world, is that it's a space for contemplation and emotion to think about parent-child relationships, sibling relationships, these things. I had a lot of interesting conversations to people who have become very personal about that parent that you're grappling with, trying to accept, you know, and all that stuff. So I don't know. I don't have a big plan when I make something. I don't have a purpose. But if it can be a space for thinking and feeling about family, then I would be very happy and grateful.
Well, Stellan Skarsgård and Joachim Trier, congratulations on Sentimental Value and congratulations on all the nominations it's getting. Thank you so much for talking to Arena again this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I can't get a handle on her, you know? The more that I study her, the more lost I feel trying to be her. It's like her sadness is... it's such an overwhelming part of her. It's a beautiful thing. But I can't tell if that's just the cause of everything, or is it, I don't know, a symptom of something deeper. Well, I don't want to disappoint him, you know.
Well, he's a very difficult person, but he is a really good director, and he sees something in you, so you'd be stupid to walk away.
And that was Elle Fanning and Renetta Rensve in a scene from Sentimental Value. The film opens in Irish cinemas on December 26th. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. A new production of The Playboy of the Western World has just opened in London. Katrina McLaughlin, Artistic Director of the Abbey Theatre, directs J.M. Singh's masterpiece at the other National Theatre, the one on the South Bank. An impressive cast is led by Nicola Coughlan as Peggy and Mike, Aina Hardwick as Christy Mahon, and Siobhan McSweeney as the Widow Quinn. Author Keelan Hughes has been to see this Playboy for us, and she joins me now on the line. Keelan, Christy Mahon has walked from Kerry to this remote corner of Mayo as the play begins, seeking sanctuary. Remind us a little bit of the plot of The Playboy of the Western World.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure you've heard, Rick, that we only have two stories. A person goes on a journey and a stranger comes to town. So this is definitely the latter. So Christopher Mahon arrives to this village in the Northwest County Mayo in a childlike, hungry state, kind of tiptoeing around the stage after 11 days walking. He's allegedly killed his father. This comes out fairly early on in the play. And so he hobbles into Flattery's Tavern, which is tended by Peggy and Mike, who's the daughter of the house. And much to Christie's and probably the audience's surprise, he's received with a hero's welcome. He's kind of seen as a fearless and savage hero who the women set about trying to woo and the men come to fear and respect. And so Peggy had been, who's I suppose the protagonist of the play, she'd been trying to get her suitor, who happens to be her second cousin, Sean Keogh, to stay overnight so she wouldn't be so afraid of this long winter night alone in the tavern. But Sean is a bit nervous about what the priest would say. And once Christy has entered the scene, she sees that he'd be a far better bouncer and better company all around.
One of the things that people know most about The Playboy of the Western World is that it caused riots when it opened in 1907, the premiere at the Abbey Theatre. Yeats returned from Scotland to address the audience on the second night, and he famously declared, "You have disgraced yourselves again." What was it that upset the public so much, do you think?
Yeah, so the riots were quite extreme. I think the Dublin police had to get involved. And then there were also riots. So that was it. In Dublin, it was in 1907. And then it toured the States in 1911. And there, the audiences, you know, booed and hissed and threw vegetables and stink bombs at the stage, deeming it to be an insult to the Irish character, even though there had been script edits taking out some of the contentious lines. There were actors arrested on indecency charges in Philadelphia. The charges were later dropped, and Theodore Roosevelt went along to a performance and kind of applauded it, and he calmed some of the unrest. But at home, ironically, politicians weren't so receptive. And so... there are many, many aspects to the play that cause these various disputes. One of them being that, or the largest one probably, and certainly internationally, being that it shattered the romanticised version of the West of Ireland and rural life. So at the time, you know, the West of Ireland was idealised as a place untouched by colonial rule. This play, you know, really depicts poverty. Also, on a separate note, lust, gullibility, the drunkenness of the characters, and on a community that are enthralled to a man with a capacity for extreme violence. So, those, you know, maybe this doesn't outrage us anymore, but at the time it did.
I want you to talk to me a little bit about Singh's style, because it was Yeats who advised Singh in the 1890s to take himself off to the Aran Islands to write. And he took that advice and it led to some of the cornerstone plays of the Irish theatrical canon, things like Riders to the Sea and The Well of the Saints, and certainly influenced that kind of heightened lyrical language that we know from his plays. What is his style like?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is that the play is written in Hiberno English, so where the syntax of the Irish language is carried over into English. So that's one thing. The second thing is the poetry. You know, Singh is a poet in the same way Shakespeare was a poet. The characters speak in metaphors, but you know, not just for the sake of flourish. They really get closer to the truth that way. It's really an enviable language. And Singh claimed to have borrowed most of it directly, barring a few words, he says, directly from the Irish peasants he met all around the country. Now, that might sound patronising. You know, he is from an upper middle class family. But I think that from reading his work, I believe that it's the opposite. You know, he really does love language that's really sincere, and he also loved the imagination of the people. There's a preface to the first publication of the play where he says, In countries where the imagination of the people and the language they use is rich and living, it's possible for a writer to be rich and copious in his words and at the same time to give the reality, which is the root of all poetry, in a comprehensive and natural form. He goes on, the whole preface is just incredible. But he does say, in Ireland for a few more years, we have a popular imagination that's fiery and magnificent and tender, so that those of us who wish to write start with a chance that's not given to writers in places where the springtime of the local life has been forgotten and the harvest is memory only and the straw has been turned into bricks. So that kind of gives you an insight into the cadence of his writing and all of the characters. You know, there is variation among them, but they all do speak in this heightened way.
You mentioned that this is a play about poverty. I mean, Peggy and Mike's engagement to Sean Keogh, it's much about economic necessity as anything else, isn't it?
It is. Can I jump back and say one other thing about the language? Because you're talking there about poverty, but so what Christie has is language. And that's really what the play is about in a way. It's really interesting to hear this in the UK right now. And the language has come up in many of the reviews as being a sticking point. It is very challenging. And I went along with an English person who did struggle for the first few scenes, but he did tune into it. And, the actors carry off the language very well. But it's so meaningful and powerful to have that Irish English spoken in the UK's National Theatre because it is the English language. It just requires you to pay heed. And that's a good thing for an Irish play. You know, it's not sit back and be entertained. It's sit forward and be enriched. You know, language is the whole point of the play. It's the instrument that Christie plays to win over the village. It's all he has. And so I think that Singh is saying, no matter how poor a person is, their capacity with language can be transformative. So that brings you on to the point of about poverty. And you're right, that Peggy and Mike's position is that, she hasn't really got many options. So when Christie arrives, poverty has a lot to do with how she reacts and also how the locals react.
Tell us about the production itself. I want to talk about a couple of things. Our own Katie Davenport designs the set and the costumes here. What about the look of the play?
So it's really stylish production. I mean, this you're certainly going to be entertained on the visual and artistic level. I mean, I overall think the production is wonderful, but it really excels in its design. So the house lights go down, and James Farncombe takes over with this gorgeous atmospheric unshowy lighting. You don't really notice it unless you're writing a review, and we get this transparent scrim of a curtain with the image of a woman seated with her knees wide apart in a layered red skirt. Her feet and shins are bare. So it's very provocative. And then behind that, once that kind of thin curtain lifts, there we have this procession of quina, the keening, mourning women who are cloaked in black head to toe, who move across the back of the stage singing a dirge in lashing rain. And I did think the rain was a little unnecessary. But then, so in the middle, in between this curtain and the queenie at the back, we have Nicola Coughlan as Peggy and Mike with her back to the audience in this huge, sparsely furnished shebeen. It's got a big corrugated iron roof and there's straw all around its perimeters. And she's wearing a blue satin corset and a pair of fuchsia red boots that are, the first kind of stamp of the fact that this is a play, this is a production that is going to have flair and richness. And I think it even queers the production. The whole way through, it's no surprise that that Katie Davenport, who you mentioned, the set and costume designer, has been front and centre in every review that I've seen. The choices are all very complex and interesting, and the programme does a really good job of giving some insight into that. You know, there's Aran jumpers, but they're ombre'd, so they go from one colour to another. There's lime green suit linings. Then there's this PVC jacket with feathered shoulders that Siobhan McSweeney, who wears magnificently as the Widow Quinn. So there's all these modern twists sitting alongside the ancient artifacts and traditions. You know, there's cowboy boots and there's also pampooties, which were these traditional homemade Aran shoes. And then there's this mumming as well is used throughout the play, really spookily. Even the fiddle player, Erin Hennessy, she wears a sackcloth and straw headpiece while playing Anna Malarkey's absolutely gorgeous, complex music. So there's so much to see and listen to.
I want to get into the performances if I can. Like, we've talked about Aina Hardwick already this week here on the programme. He's soon to be on our cinema screens playing Roy Keane in Saipan. But what kind of Christie man does he give us?
Oh, yes. Well, he's absolutely wonderful. I don't know if you've seen him in The Sixth Commandment, but I think it's the best miniseries I've ever seen, if not one of the best TV shows I've seen. His performance is very unusual. I've seen a lot of productions of Playboy, and I've not seen a performance or an interpretation of Christie like this. I suspect he struck me as playing him as a neurodivergent character, and it's a very unexpected and daring performance, very physically involved, and he really does have a huge range.
There's a great cast aside from the main roles as well. It does go all the way down. The play is set in a pub run by Lorcan Cranitch as Peg Ian's father. Michael Marty Ray is Sean Keogh. Peg Ian's fiancé Declan Conlon is Old Mahon. Who stands out for you in those performances?
Well, Siobhan McSweeney really surprised me as the Widow Quinn. It's such a fabulous role. You know, she's more slippery than Peg Ian. Peg Ian's sort of see what you get. She's very pragmatic. There's not that much subtext. The Widow Quinn is also very pragmatic and forthright, but she's more vulnerable in how she shows her cards, even when she knows that playing them isn't really an option to her any longer. And I was fearful that she might play the part with a combination of deadpan, which, you know, we've seen in Derry Girls and in Amanda Land, and slapstick. But I was absolutely wrong. She watched this. She brings more, I think, to the character than is obvious on the page. She's hilarious and subtle and earnest and really convincing. She has the highlight moment of the play for me, which was at the end of Act Two, just before the interval curtain.
You touched on this earlier. As an Irish person watching this in the National Theatre of the UK, with a presumably mostly non-Irish audience around you, and with a production that makes no concessions in terms of dialogue, for instance, were you having a different experience than the people around you, do you think?
I think I was. I'd also read the play a few days prior, just because I wanted to be, I'm so enamoured of the play. I wanted to remind myself what I loved about the play itself so that I could really see what the production was doing. So I think it's very helpful, and I'd really recommend anyone going planning to go and see it to read it in advance. That will really allow you to enjoy the language of the play rather than trying to concentrate on what's going on. Now, the first few scenes of the play are all of the action sits within the dialogue. So that's the challenge at the beginning, just to get that entry point, because you don't have so many cues coming from the action, which you do, you know, once you're at the midway point. From then on, there's so much activity that you can, you know, you can parse everything that's happening. But at the beginning, I think it helps to have read, I think, especially for non-Irish people attending. But on press night, there was a huge Irish contingent in the audience. So I think everyone was really enjoying it. You know, reviews have been sitting around the 3-star mark for this. And I've been quite surprised at the at that, because for me, it's a very strong 4-star performance. And I suspect that it has something to do with the final moment in the play. The fact that, so the character Peggy Mike, who's played by Nicola Coughlan, she falls to her knees and cries out, "I've lost the only playboy of the Western world." And then she breaks into a kind of Brechtian wail until the curtain falls. And it felt like a moment from a different performance and even a different play. So afterwards, I went back to the text to see what Singh's directions had been. And he has landed the performance, like, you know, had it been this impossible proposition where there was this huge shift in tone, but no. So in the text, he says that Peggy lifts her shawl over her head and she breaks into wild lamentations. And then she says, "Oh my grief, I've lost him surely. I've lost the only playboy of the Western world." Curtain. And I think that totally changes the tone. Peggy costumes herself to indicate the grief. She wails, then the language has the final say. You know, and the conclusion in that line is that something has been lost. And so I think that the reviewers who've spoken about a confused tone, a number of them have mentioned that final moment. And I think it doesn't work because, you know, it's almost as if the curtain has come up on the audience in a Brechtian way, accusing them for whatever they'd been laughing at. And that's not, I think, you know, the way that it reads on the page. It's a choice, but to my eye, that didn't land. But there's so much to enjoy in the production, in the performances. It's so playful and powerful and artful and layered. So I think it's very well worth seeing.
Keelan Hughes, thanks so much for joining us on tonight's Arena. That is the programme for tonight. Shanna Gorman was the producer. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Mark McGrath was on sound. Tomorrow night here on Arena, we'll be reviewing the week's new films. That includes the table tennis tale, Marty Supreme, the new Josh Safdie film, the third Avatar, Fire and Ash, and what we're referring to now is the national trauma drama of Saipan. We'll also take a look at the 50th anniversary remaster of the Pink Floyd album, Wish You Were Here. That's all on Arena tomorrow night from 7 here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon is next after the news, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.